Welcome to our two-part end-of-year special for the Grave Talks. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. Over this week and next week, we're going to take a look back at some of our favorite interviews and segments that we've captured over the last 365 days and discuss how the show began, answer some of your questions about the program, how it all got underway, and really take an in-depth look at our first year on the air. From a personal standpoint, I cannot thank you enough for the support of getting behind this show. It means the world to me. Obviously, Real Ghost Stories Online now has been around for almost 6 years, and that to me is just an awesome thing. I never in my wildest dreams thought I would be able to do a ghost show on a regular basis. More or less two ghost shows now on a regular basis, and have the support that it has from you guys and allow it to be such a huge part of my life. It really, it's amazing. It allows me to do what I love. It allows you guys to hear some awesome stuff, and I cannot thank you enough for the support. And I truly mean that from the bottom of my heart. So, for New Year's here and for Christmas weeks, I thought, let's do this. Let's take a look back. Let's answer some questions. Let's kind of get some grounding on where the show is right now, what we've done over the last year, and where it's headed in the next many, many years, because this thing's not ending. This is a pirate ship that's out there, and it's at sea, and it's open waters, and I'm very, very excited about it. So how did the Grave Talks start? That's a question that I get quite a bit because it's obviously not Real Ghost Stories Online. It's a totally separate show. And really, it was just kind of one of those things where I had wanted to do another podcast about something for quite a while. And honestly, this was one of the first concepts that I came up with. But it was one of the last I acted on. I thought, well, I'm going to try some other ideas here first. And we did try a couple other ideas. And, you know, with mixed success, nothing ever to the level of Real Ghost Stories Online. And when I got to the point of some of the others, just kind of going, yeah, I think I should try that one. That one seems like it's kind of a home run, and it's just sitting right here, and I don't know why I haven't done it. So what I did was I was wrapping up the Dream Meetings podcast after running that one for almost more than half a year, and I really did enjoy doing that, and we had a bit of an audience there, but it was just, it wasn't quite catching the way I wanted it to. And then I just thought, okay, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to start reaching out. I'm going to get some interviews put together, and I'm just going to see how it goes. And I'm going to get 10 episodes in the can, which means you record them before you ever release them or really have actual direction on the show. And I'm going to do this. So I did. I recorded the first 10 episodes starting in late 2017, right? Because we're in 2018 now. So it would have been late 2017. I started recording those. And then we launched the show, I believe it around the beginning of February in 2018. And it was launched with, I believe, like 3, 4, 5 episodes just out there at once. And then it just kept going. And the commitment was a new episode every single week. And I thought, I can manage this. And so I just started looking into who to talk to. I started just kind of looking up haunted experiences and places, sending out emails, making calls, reaching out to some folks that we've talked to in the past on Real Ghost Stories Online. And it just felt right. And immediately you guys started following it, started downloading it. And the download numbers were really good right off the bat. It's not up to the level of Real Ghost Stories Online yet. But I would not be surprised, honestly, if one day it's neck and neck, if not beating it with download numbers. So it's a very difficult show to produce because it takes a lot of time to put the whole thing together. But I love doing it, and I love hearing these stories. And I feel like it's giving me more perspective than ever before on the stuff that we talk about. so that I have more insight for Real Ghost Stories Online than I ever did, especially when it comes to investigations and kind of some theories and paths and how all this stuff works. But that's how it all began. It was just more so a, I really want to do this. Let's just do it. And I did it. And that's how it happened. How did we come up with some of the ideas for our first episodes and our interviews? It really was somewhat random. There was a couple people that I knew I definitely wanted to reach back out to and do a follow-up with because it'd been years since I talked to them last, like Andrea Perrin, who was actually one of the first three episodes of Real Ghost Stories Online, and it had been since that time that I had talked to her. And I knew she had a new book out, and I wanted to do a follow-up because we had talked to her right when The Conjuring had come out about her experiences in that house. And it's been several years now, and The Conjuring universe has turned into its own thing. So I wanted to kind of get her perspective on how everything had transpired into the future and into the years since we last spoke and find out what's going on with her. So I definitely wanted to reach out and see if she'd want to come back on the show. And she did. And I was thrilled because she is still one of my favorite interviews of all time.
Well, you know, you are one of the most professional people in the business. And I thoroughly recall and thoroughly enjoyed my first interview with you. And this just, you know, carried on the tradition. Let me just say publicly here and now, I am at your disposal whenever you want to have a chat with me. You just let me know.
Let's talk a little bit about revisionist history and when your father made the decision to kick the Warrens out of the home after the botched seance that almost killed your mother. What was the reasoning? What was his mindset at that moment to get those people out of the house?
So that he wouldn't kill them. He was that angry. I've never seen him so angry. As far as he was concerned, when he threw them out of the house, he didn't yet know if my mother had even survived what had happened to her. It took him quite a while. He checked all of her vital signs. She was knocked unconscious. The Warrens did not want us to call the police. They did not want us to call for an ambulance. We were instructed by them not to call the authorities. And my father was down on his hands and knees over my mother, who was laying in the middle of the parlor floor. You know, everyone in that house heard her skull hit that floor. She had been tossed more than 20 feet from the middle of our dining room into the parlor in a captain's chair, in a chair that probably weighed 30 or 40 pounds, and just picked up and tossed in a split second. And everybody in that house thought they had just watched her die. And my father was so busy trying to bring her back that he didn't even call for help. But he threw the Warrens out of the house because it was that, or he had already just punched Ed Warren in the face and bloodied his nose and broke his nose and took him to the floor, a man twice his size. So it was going to get really ugly if we didn't get them out of there.
Did any of the documentation that was attempting to be done when that horrific event occur survive? Any of the audio, any of the video, did anything make it out the door?
No, none of it did. There was no audio, and the video cameras that had been set up in the basement had been shattered when the cinematographers went back downstairs to get their state-of-the-art equipment. It was in pieces all over the cellar, and both of those men came upstairs sobbing with what little they were able to. There was nothing salvageable, but, you know, they grabbed what they could. Their tripods and stuff like that. It looked like something had just picked up the tripod with the camera on it, folded the legs, and used that tripod as a baseball bat, and taken those cameras and slammed them into solid granite walls. And there was no one in the basement when that happened. The cellar was vacant of human beings when that happened. And, you know, it seems to me if there was any film footage, any audio or video that had actually been salvaged from that night, that would have made its way out into the public sector sometime around The Conjuring. I don't think that it exists.
After all that happened, was there ever any communication, again, at that period in time, between your family and the Warrens?
The Warrens came back about 3-4 months later, right around Halloween of that year. So it was approximately 2 years after they had originally shown up at our door. My mother had no idea who they were when they came to the door. So that was another thing that the movie got wrong, because it intimated that she went and sought them out. She had no idea who this couple was, but it was a cold night and she invited them in to warm up. The only other time that we had any physical contact with them was just about 3 months after that incident, and they came to the house. They waited until they saw that my father's car was not there. Obviously, they did not want an altercation with him. And my mother opened the kitchen door and spoke with them through the screen. And basically, they said they wanted to come and see if she was all right, because they left that house that night not knowing what her condition was. And my mother assured them that she was fine, but she did not invite them across our threshold ever again. And they turned and they left and they went back to Connecticut. Then in 1980, Mrs. Warren called my mother about 3 months after we moved to Georgia, sold the farm and moved to another home. And she wanted to offer my family a boatload of money to tell our story. And she had a ghostwriter with her, which I love that phrase, with her, named Gerald Brittle, who has since sued and lost a claim against Warner Brothers for actually having all the rights to a story that he has zero rights to. And she had him with her on the other end of the phone. And I was home with my mother when the phone call came. And Mrs. Warren wanted to tell our story in print and on screen, and my mother declined, and Mrs. Warren said, you have to at least discuss this with your husband. This is too much money to just say no to. And so my mother agreed that she would discuss it with my father that night. When he came home, he gathered all of us up, and we went on an excursion into town to have dinner. And my mother decided to stay home alone. And that night, when she went down to throw a load of laundry into the washing machine in the cellar of our new house, she was attacked, physically attacked. And the next day, when Mrs. Warren called her back, she said, the answer is no, and please don't ever contact us again. So, you know, Cindy says that attack, even though it really hurt my mother physically, was the best thing that ever happened to her, because she felt like it stopped everything. It not only stopped any further discourse with the Warrens, but it also prompted my mother to beckon the power of her own Cherokee ancestors to lift this burden from her. And it worked. And for all these years, she's been free of it.
How about later in time, once several pages had been turned on the chapter of your family's life in that home, and many years later when The Conjuring came out, was there any interaction at that point with the Warrens and any perspective given on what happened there or what their viewpoint was on what happened there?
Yes, actually. Mrs. Warren and I was invited out. I brought my sister Cindy with me, and Lorraine brought Tony, her son-in-law, with her, and the four of us went out in March of 2013. We were graciously invited to a private screening of The Conjuring 3 months before its release. And Warner Brothers put us up in a beautiful hotel in West Hollywood, and They did a whole series of interviews with myself and my sister and did all the background on our family story. Consequently, they were doing the same thing with Lorraine. You know, it was really, it behooved them to have us out there, not only to get our initial visceral response to The Conjuring and with their fingers crossed that it would be good, but also so that they could get all of their background information ready to put out in the packages that go with the films. So it served a dual purpose. And when I came out of the elevator, Cindy and I came out of one elevator, and the elevator right next to it opened simultaneously, and there was Lorraine Warren, and neither of us has seen her in 40 years. And she opened her arms, and we just embraced. I don't think they ever, ever tried to do anything to hurt us deliberately. My father thinks that they, you know, were trying to exploit us for their own gain, and there's an argument to be made for that. But I looked these people in the eyes, you know, when I was a teenager, when you're most open and you're also most watchful. And, you know, I never felt that they wanted, they never asked my parents for a dime. They made that trip from Connecticut 4 or 5 times in terms of conducting an investigation of the property. And yes, they did talk out of school about things that happened at our house that started drawing people to the house. They were dropping our name. They were talking about Harrisville. It was easy enough for anybody that was interested to come into town and go to the general store and find out where the house was. So, you know, they made some mistakes. They did. Lorraine even admitted to me that they were in over their heads from the inception, and that her Ed's last request of her prior to his death was to make sure that the Perrin family story got told, because he always insisted verbally and in print that it was, and these are his words, of all the investigations they conducted over 40 years as paranormal investigators, they described our haunting as the most intense, disturbing, and significant of all the investigations that they ever conducted.
What I really thought was neat about the first 5 episodes or so of the show, looking back, is that they were all a bit different, and they all really kind of set the tone for how this show would go. It's not just a haunted location. It's not just a haunted person. It's really getting in depth to the history. It's really getting in depth to the story of whatever the topic is, but it's focusing on that topic. Sometimes it's even a city. Sometimes it can be a state. You know, whatever it is, we talk about it with a lot of detail. And that's what I really, really love about it. One of the first really detailed episodes that I was blown away by was the episode, I believe it was the second episode that we had on the program, talking about the haunting in Watervliet. And it turned into a 2-parter because the conversation I was having with her was just so interesting and so good. And it ended up just going way long, but we were able to turn it into 2 totally separate episodes. One about what was leading up to happening in her home, and then what happened in the aftermath of what transpired to be a tragic story, but an amazing story in terms of a haunting.
Heading into the fall, we had a lot of paranormal activity in the house. Some of it's mentioned in 207. Some of it I did not mention until Saints, because there was one thing, there was random, really bizarre knocking that we would hear in the living room, which is where the haze was. There were 2 doors you could go into the living room from the hallway. And I remember going to answer the door a couple times and nobody was there. And I would say, my God, I said, what am I losing it? Because I'm hearing somebody knock on the door. Well, this one time, my mom was over, she heard it. And I was like, don't even open the door. I said, there must be something going on, meaning pipe-wise, there must be something going on. We're not expecting anybody. It's the same knocking and the same doors. So it was always the living room door. So I basically kind of just dealt with that. But then one night my husband heard the knocking, and literally you would go out in the hallway and it was confusing because you would swear somebody was at the door. And he even said the same thing. That's so weird. But we would have, my mother gave us a wooden carving, beautiful wall decoration that would not stay on any of the dining room walls. You could put it on any other wall, but it wouldn't stay on the dining room wall. It would come crashing to the floor. After several times moving it around in the dining room, which is where I wanted it, it was, you couldn't repair it. I had an incident where I was ironing. Everything was fine, and it was not the iron. We didn't have another problem with the switch or with the plug, but sparks literally flew out and caught my shirt from the bottom of the iron, caught my shirt on fire. And I literally ran in and threw the iron into the sink. My husband was having some bizarre nightmares. Our friend came over again and spent another night on the couch. He was dating my friend. And he had another nightmare, very similar, he said, he said, I don't know. He goes, I don't think it's me. He goes, I think it's the house. And Jim would consistently make fun of anybody that had mentioned any kind of strange feeling. And I was asking our friends, and I was asking around, do you know any history here? Downstairs neighbor wouldn't talk. I thought that was a little strange. Nice man, but he wouldn't talk about the history of the house. And I was just convinced I knew there was at least one male spirit in our apartment. And there was something very different about his essence, I guess. So rather than talk about it in the apartment, I talked about it like with our neighbors outside and just did what I could. His behavior relative to my husband, by November, we had an odor. We came home from work and walked upstairs, and as we were walking upstairs, you could smell it. It did smell, to be completely honest with you, it smelled like a dead animal. And we're like, what the heck is going on? And it was right before my son's baptism, which was November 27th. So what ended up happening was we couldn't find anything. It just kept getting stronger. It was horrible. We turned off the heat. It used to be Niagara Mohawk at the time this happened. Now it's National Grid. Called them. They ended up, everybody had to leave the house because it was very evident there was this horrific smell permeating. It, like I said, we could smell it going upstairs, but once we were in the apartment, it took over the whole house. So they tagged the furnace thinking it was an issue. 2 days, they looked into it. They called us and said everybody can go back because all three families had to leave. And they never found the cause. And we thought it was a dead animal possibly in the wall. And they said no, because it was bizarre what happened. And even Niagara Mohawk said the same thing, that they could not trace where it was coming from. It seemed to be coming from the basement at one time up into our apartment. And then other times it seemed to be focused in the apartment. So that, you know, that legitimately happened and was very strange. It was my husband's behavior the day of the baptism. I look now with hindsight after everything happened, and we have pictures. I posted pictures on the website. There's a picture of him, and he looks very upset. And it's the day of our son's baptism.
What was a location that we've talked about that I've been to? There's actually been at least two, I think, is the answer to that question. Locations that I've been to that I'm quite fond of, actually. One right down the road from us, the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. It's less than an hour drive away. And when I did this interview, I had yet to actually set foot on the property because my wife wouldn't let me for a long period of time. Then we were down there in summer, And we had stayed in Eureka Springs, not at the Crescent. We stayed at a different place. And we were trying to figure out something to do. And before we left, and we went to Sunday brunch at the Crescent. And it was very nice. And we even had a paranormal experience. My credit card went flying across the room. And not because I threw it at the waiter. No, they were very nice. And it was literally, I was paying for brunch. I gave it to the waiter. And they do this in their old ballroom. He took it up to the bar, had it in the little folder that you put your credit card in, and set it down. And then when he went to reach for it, I'm not kidding you, I saw this happen with my own eyes. And it went flying out of the folder thing, and it like shot across the bar towards where like the buffet line was. It was like it went towards the pasta salads and just fell on the ground. But it shot. It wasn't like, oh, it just kind of slid out. I mean, it boom, it went almost as if somebody flicked it, or it was projectiled across the room. And I said, well, that's, we got something at least. That was the end of it. My haunted credit card. But what a story of the Crescent Hotel. We've been getting stories from the Crescent for years and years and Real Ghost Stories Online. So I was thrilled to be able to talk to their director of like the paranormal activities and their tours, because they really, this is a hotel that lives it up. One of the few super functioning hotels that really, really gets into the ghost stuff. Comparable to like the Stanley in Colorado. It really, really has an interesting story. And what an interesting interview, hearing why this place is haunted.
Within a couple of years, all those people, those 15,000 people who came to town, they were all sick. And they were all bringing a variety of illnesses with them. And when they arrived, there were absolutely no services. There was no sanitation. There was no anything, just the spring. And then more and more springs were discovered, till now we have 63 springs. They all put out their claims for being healing springs, and different springs were supposedly good for different things. The interesting thing is that we have hundreds of testimonials from people who were cured, apparently, by the springs, however you choose to explain that. This is, of course, before science took over from superstition. So this was at the 1880s, and a gentleman came to town who saw the mess that was these people trying to survive in these overcrowded unsanitary conditions, and had a vision of a health resort. His name was Powell Clayton, and he's the first governor of Arkansas after the Civil War. He saw the state through Reconstruction. He was a northerner. He was not all that popular, but he was a civil engineer, and he was a go-getter, and he had good connections. So he got a group of his business acquaintances together, including people from the railroads, and they set about creating a city out of the mess that was Eureka Springs at the time. So they laid in some streets and some street lighting. They laid in some transportation and some sanitation and drainage. And they brought in, the important thing is they brought in the railroad, brought in a branch line down from Seligman, 26 miles across some of the roughest terrain, crossing and recrossing rivers, blasting big gaps in cliff sides, and apparently the most expensive railroad line built in the country up until that time, 26 miles of it. So at the end of that railroad line, the governor, ex-governor, they called him the Brigadier General, is what they always called him, because it was his title in the Civil War. He built a hotel. He built the Crescent Hotel, which at that time was the finest hotel west of the Mississippi. It had, it had a working elevator. It had Edison lighting, steam heat. It had a huge ballroom with an in-house orchestra. They had a stable for 100 horses. They had tennis courts and swimming pools and even bowling alleys. They had everything there for a very, very luxurious stay for anybody who happened to know Powell Clayton. It was called a hotel, but really speaking, you had to be on a list in order to get in. Just about as hard as getting to a club in Los Angeles. It was not anybody could make a reservation.
A very exclusive building for very exclusive people of the day with very exclusive decisions to be made.
I think of this as Powell Clayton's kind of like his own Camp David. He was still very involved in politics, even though he was no longer in office. But I think that a lot of the decisions that were made about the future of this region got made behind closed doors, over brandy and cigars probably, within the walls of the Crescent Hotel. It's, if you look at it today, it stands on top of a mountain. It's got 360 views on all sides, so we can see his forest when we look out, but all the way to the horizon. And its walls are dry stacked limestone, 18 inches thick and 3 feet thick in some places. So the place looks kind of like a fortress. And in those days, the 1880s, there was still a whole lot of turmoil in the state. And a lot of people had refused to accept that the Civil War was over, and there was a lot of insecurity. So I believe that's the reason why it looks more like a castle than it looks like what you might expect from a regular hotel. So the building has tons of character. It's an amazing location. It looks down over the valley. It's sort of presiding over the city, the small city down below. And our very first ghost, actually, that we have record of in the hotel is from one of the stonemasons who built the Crescent Hotel in the first place. It was built in 1886, started in 84, at a cost of $294,000. One of the stonemasons, young man named Michael, we believe, fell to his death from the very top when he was working before all the rooms were put in, when it was just a shell. He took a fall. The story is that he just liked the girls, and he saw a beautiful girl walking down below and tried to get her attention, and it didn't work. So he tried a little harder, and eventually he was dancing up and down on top of the wall and took a tumble all the way down the middle. And he landed on a beam and lost his life. The beam is now the floor of room 218, which is our most notorious and most requested room in the hotel. That was the very first of the spirits that inhabit the building came from its construction, and it may have something to do with why it became so active in future years. Well, that takes us up as far as the direction of the building, construction of the building. Around the turn of the century, for one reason or another, people stopped coming to take the waters in such great numbers. Maybe they stopped working for one reason or another. Maybe people stopped believing that they would work. But anyway, around the same time, Powell Clayton got kicked upstairs. He got made the first ambassador to Mexico from the United States. So he left town, and there was a recession. The railroad withdrew all its funding from the hotel, which it had supported. And the hotel sort of went on the skids for a little while. And so in 1908, to maintain the building, it was leased out as a woman's college for 9 months of the year. It's called the Crescent College and Conservatory. And it served in that function for the next quarter of a century. And here's another interesting thing. When I first started in this job, which is about 6 years ago, not much was known about the girls at the college. But in trying to investigate history and trying to get the stories straight, which had been so distorted over the years, we made a lot of discoveries. One of the big discoveries is we thought that the girls who came here were daughters of wealthy families who were sort of, it was like a finishing school, and maybe they'd learn a little home ec, maybe they'd learn how to run a plantation. What we discovered was, in fact, it was an extremely progressive school. devoted largely to music, and they brought in the structures from Europe. And they were also learning physics and chemistry and law and geology and all kinds of things that you wouldn't expect that young ladies of those that era would need. And then when we pursued their histories after they left there, we found a lot of them became great movers and shakers. They were designers and composers and artists and legislators. A lot of women who went on to make a name for themselves. And the curious thing about it is this isolated building way off in the Ozarks. It wasn't even a hard road to get here in those days. But they came from 39 different states to get their education here. And it was a very, very prestigious college, which is sort of an understanding that's just risen to the surface in the last few years. We now have an exhibit in the hotel, a museum devoted to those girls. And it's possible to track their lives, at least the ones that we've managed to catch up on so far. And it seems like almost daily we're starting to hear from descendants of those girls. Oh, that was my great grandmother went to that school, and I have some photographs you can have. So that whole aspect of the school is of the hotel of the present is expanding daily. So there are several stories, ghost stories also, that come from that period of time when it was a school during the school years. That stops in 1934. Depression brought everything to a grinding halt, and Arkansas was in big trouble at the time. They had floods, they'd had pestilence, they'd had drought, and then the depression on top of everything else. So the Pleasant Hotel actually closed down for 3 years. There was nothing going on at all, just silence and birds and perhaps a few ghosts up here on top of the mountain. Then in 1937, an individual came to town. Came motoring up the hill in a lavender car, wearing a white suit and a purple shirt. And this guy was known all over the country at the time as a broadcaster. His name was Norman Baker, and he had one of those border blasters that was built just over the border in Mexico from Laredo, Texas, in Nuevo Laredo. He had a transmitter big enough that he could be heard all over the country. He could be heard in the Aleutian Islands. And he used his radio station largely to promote his particular political ideals, but also to advertise what he called his secret remedy, number 5, which was a guaranteed cure for cancer. Guaranteed cure in 1934.
And so the lore continued of people to visit Eureka Springs for its amazing power of its spring water and whatever concoctions the quote-unquote doctor had come up with.
Well, this guy was very plausible. He was very charming. He was also brilliant. He had made several fortunes and several other ventures before he even discovered quack medicine. But he sort of maintained most of his other businesses, but he didn't put as much energy into them when he found out how much money there was available. During the Depression, in quack medicine, and it's called the Golden Age of Quackery, there were actually a lot of people making a lot of money in the Depression off people's desperation. And several of these radio stations along the border, in fact, that's where the country and Western music tradition sort of developed, and the Carter family and people like that, Howlin' Wolf, were all involved in those radio stations. Norman Baker came here. He was tired of living in Mexico, and there were rumors of a civil war, and he was looking for somewhere else to go. And he found this building sitting empty, and he bought it for a song. And he bought it for $40,000 with the building and two parks, one on each side that surround it. And he set up a hospital in there. He called it the Baker Cancer Curable Hospital. And he sent out 250,000 brochures across the country, inviting people to come and be cured, guaranteed cure, in 6 weeks at his facility. he was a very combative fellow. I mean, he was always in litigation, and he was always bad-mouthing any kind of authoritarian institution from the government on down, including the American Medical Association, which he called the American Meat Cutters Association. And his sales pitch was, you've tried x-ray, radium, and surgery. They didn't work. Come to me, and I guarantee I will cure you with my secret remedy number 5.
Another location that really spoke to me and I was really excited about talking about was Mackinac Island in Michigan. It's a place that I have visited since I was a child. I was able to take our family there last year. They loved it. And it's been a place that, I don't know, there's very few places in that I visited that just kept drawing me back. So much so to the point when I was in my 20s, I decided to go live in that area, not on the island, but very close by, so I could visit it on a semi-regular basis. And I did, and I absolutely loved it. But there's just always been something about that place. It's never really struck me as, I guess, spooky per se, but I think haunting would be a better word for it. And for good reason, we learned in the interview about Mackinac Island and the ghosts of Mackinac Island.
There's a lot of stories out there. There's a lot of stories that I get sit there, I look at, scratch my head. I go, where'd they get that one? Because that doesn't make any sense at all. I hear stories about ghosts all the time up there. I've been doing this since I was a little kid. My interest in paranormal and everything. So it's been a long time, and I know what's a long tail and what's kind of got, okay, maybe you got something there. There's something unusual, and it fits the history. But typically the Grand Hotel does not like to talk about their ghosts, and their employees aren't allowed to do it. But I have friends at the Grand Hotel who are willing to talk about it. I've talked to numerous tourists who've had experiences at the Grand Hotel. And back about 100, maybe 80 years ago, they would talk, whoever was running it at the time, and I don't recall who it was running at the time, they used to publish a, like, Grand Hotel magazine for the people who were staying at the resort. And that was the only place I've ever seen the actual hotel come out publicly and say, we have a ghost story, officially. That one is known as the Woman in Black, and the story behind her is it was roughly around time of Titanic, 19 teens. A woman shows up. She has guys, footmen, which are the guys who would carry your bags and take care of everything. She had assistants. She had everything. She had two very large Afghan hounds, and she was dressed completely in black, and she had a veil over her face. You couldn't see her face in black. Checks into the Grand Hotel. Goes to one of the best rooms in the hotel, never leaves that room except to walk her dogs two or three times a day on the front porch, let them do their business on the front porch, and then goes back to her room. When she checked out, nobody saw her leave, just her servants did all the paperwork and checked her out and everything, and she was gone. And the legend of it is that when she left, a black raven landed on the windowsill of the bedroom she slept in and stayed there for 3 days. Strange. But people have reported, and I haven't heard any reports within the past few years, of a woman walking two large dogs on the porch. And if you've ever seen the porch, it's 660 feet long. You stand at one end and you can see a little bit of a person at the other end. It's a pretty big porch. It's actually the biggest porch, I think, in the world. And they'll see a woman walking two large dogs, but if she's walking towards you, she never gets to you. She vanishes before she gets to you. Some people have reported seeing her from the dining room, which is right on the porch. They'll look out the window and they'll see a woman undressed in black with two large dogs walking down the porch. And they're just like, that's weird. So,
is there any documentation as to who she was or may have been?
We have no idea who she was. Some people think she was an actress from New York. Some people said she was a wealthy wife from some sort of lumber baron or something along those lines, a widow. She's dressed in black. No one's really sure, and I've asked people at the hotel if they could find out. They're like, no, there's no way we would be able to find that. The records might exist, but they wouldn't even know where to start, especially if she came in under an assumed name. They would never know which one it was, or they couldn't find out who she was. That's the only report that they ever released that was officially Grand Hotel related, and all the other ones are hearsay and what people have said and reported and everything like that. There was a little girl that, and he was the 50s, might have been the early 60s. She was on about in a higher room, and she was sitting against the window, and screen popped out. She fell. She died. Her ghost is known to haunt. She's a little girl. She's playful. Everybody calls her Rebecca. And I actually have talked to kids. She appears to kids more than she does to adults. I've talked to kids, and when kids tell you the story, they do it with all their enthusiasm and, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I'm telling this. Oh, you're going to think I'm crazy. The mom's pushing. Tell him. He's the guy who knows about the ghost stories up here. Tell him what you saw. And one kid came to me, and he said he's walking down the hallway towards his room, and a little girl was near the door of his room, and she had a big colorful ball. And she looked at him, waved, and then rolled the ball towards him, and he watched the ball come towards him, and he was watching it. He went down to grab it, and went to grab it. It wasn't there. He looks up. The girl's gone. There's nobody there. He's like, I know she was there. She was there. I know it. And so I assume that was the Rebecca ghost that people have talked about seeing in there. They have a kids club area. They named it, I think it's called Rebecca's Kids Club or something like that. And I don't think it's named after her, but I just thought it was kind of funny, the coincidence. The name is the same as the little girl. Other people have heard the jingling of keys in hallways, especially in the winter. Some of the people who work on the place say they hear it sounds like a security guard belt, jingling keys, walking through hallways when they know no one's there. Phones ringing in the middle of the winter when the phone lines are shut down. I mean, there's logical, possible answers to what could be doing it. I mean, it could be a surge in the line caused the phone to ring, electrical, I don't know. But another one that I've actually heard from several guests is you don't see anything. It's all auditory. You hear the whole experience. Staying in rooms above the dining room, occasionally in the middle of the night, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, you start hearing the clatter and chatter, big band music playing down below in the dining room. And one person said they even went down to the floor, put their ear on the floor, and it was clear as a bell. They could hear this happening, and they said it wasn't pipes, it wasn't anything like that. It was literally, you could hear people talking, you could hear horns, you could hear clanging of plates, and they called down to the front desk and said, what in the world's going on down in the dining room? This is really loud, it's keeping us awake. And they're like, the dining room's empty. He didn't believe them, so he went down, he got dressed and went down and looked into the dining room, and you look through the glass doors, and it was lights out and empty, and there was nothing in there. So that's one I've actually heard from 4 guests that have come to me to tell me about that. Strange residual sound of a huge party in the dining room.
I don't think I'll ever get sick of hearing stories about the ghosts of Mackinac Island. That's going to wrap up our first episode of the end of the year. Look back at 2018 and the Grave Talks. Next week, we'll talk about some of the most compelling ghost stories that we've heard and play back some clips from those episodes. Don't miss it. If you're looking for fresh new episodes right now, you can get them months before they're released. Yes, already well into the new year. At our website at thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month, you'll have access to advanced episodes of the show, like I said, that are months in advance of release. You get access to them and the exclusive part twos of our interview shows, part twos that are only for gravekeepers. Patreon.com/thegravetalks, or go to our website, thegravetalks.com, to click on the link there. Until next week for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.